Have you ever heard of the Carnegie Hero Medal? I must admit, I had never heard of it until just this past week. I was reading an article about somebody who had won the Carnegie Hero Medal, and I didn't have any idea what it was, so I began to do a little research. Most of you, I would guess, have heard the name Andrew Carnegie. He's a famous philanthropist from the 18 and 1900s. He gave away much of his money in a number of different ways. He had, for much of his life, wanted to find a way to recognize those who had risked everything to help strangers. And so in 1904, when a coal mine experienced a tremendous collapse and 181 people lost their lives just a short distance from his home in Pittsburgh, he was most amazed by two individuals that in the midst of the collapse rushed in an attempt to save the miners. Unfortunately, they were unsuccessful in saving the miners' lives as well as their own. And so in 1904, he began to give out a medal that he called the Heroes Medal. And since 1904, some 9,000 plus people have received the award. And just recently, I was reading some of the stories. Stories of a gentleman by the name of Joseph Anthony Jones, a 51-year-old factory worker who lived outside of Fruitland, Ohio. When one evening, as he was already in bed, he heard what sounded like a car accident, and he threw on a pair of shoes and went out and began to explore. To his horror, he noticed that one of the cars that had been in the collision had slid off the road and the engine compartment was burning. He noticed that there was a young lady attempting to get out of the car but was trapped. He rushed over, and as the flames began to fill the car, he noticed she was tangled in her seatbelt, and she helped the young mother out of the car, but then noticed that there was a four-year-old trapped in her car seat. He tried his best ability to get the car seat free, and when he was unable, he went to the other side of the car, smashed in the window, reached into a burning car, and rescued the four-year-old. The mother was treated for her injuries. Anthony had sustained several cuts to his arm, and the little girl, Destiny, was rescued. But the saddest part of the award is that approximately 20% of the recipients receive it posthumously. People like Robert Benordes, who was a skydiving instructor. He was taking a young lady out for her first solo free fall. They jumped out of the plane at 12,000 feet, and they were to free fall for 63 seconds, at which time she was to pull her cord. However, once out in the free fall, she began to panic, and while there were three of them in the formation, she figured out a way to get all three of them into what they call a cone shape, which means your speed goes from 120 to 170. Having the amount of time you have to pull the ripcord. When she began to get dangerously close to the time in which she was to pull it, she panicked and didn't pull it, and Robert managed to get around her, and in the last possible second pulled her ripcord, but then did not have time to pull his. And Robert gave his life to save a stranger's life. I think the most amazing act any of us will ever see is the willingness to risk and perhaps even give your life for a stranger. But would you give your life for an enemy? If you have your Bibles, would you go with me back to the Gospel of Luke? And we are in chapter 19 this morning, and we're coming to a major close to the third section of the Gospel of Luke. We have shared many times that Luke is made up really of four major sections. There's the arrival of Jesus in the first three chapters as we see his birth and his arrival on the scene at his baptism. And then beginning in chapter 4, we move to his words and his works, and we follow Jesus around Galilee as he performs some of these amazing words and works. And then in chapter 9, he turns and he heads towards the city of Jerusalem. And we have been following Jesus now for a year as we've watched in chapter 9 and 10 as he's making this journey down to the city of Jerusalem. And a couple weeks ago, we came to chapter 18. And in verse number 31 of chapter 18, we see that Jesus says to his disciples that we are almost here. We're going up to the city of Jerusalem, and once I'm there, everything that was written by the prophets, everything that was written in the Old Testament will be fulfilled as I will be handed over to the Gentiles, I will be shamefully treated, I will be spit upon, I will be flogged, and then ultimately I will die and then rise on the third day. Chapter 19, verses 1 to 10 is where we're going to be, but I just kind of want to set it in its context. After verse 10, we come to verse 11, in which Jesus then turns to them, and those who heard the last statement we'll look at in a minute, he says, then suddenly he proceeded to tell them a parable as he went to Jerusalem. As he's going to Jerusalem, he tells this parable, and then he arrives in verse number 28, and he went on ahead going up to Jerusalem. And we see the triumphal entry. May I suggest chapter 19 is one last stop before Jesus enters the Passion Week. One final time before Jesus arrives in the city of Jerusalem, he is about to stop and minister to one last person. But if I may begin at the end of the passage this morning, I'm convinced that as Luke writes from the words of Jesus that he came to seek and to save the lost, I don't believe that's so much a summary of simply the story in the first 10 verses of Luke. I think that is a summary of Jesus' mission. To be sure, Jesus' mission on earth was complicated. He came to reveal to us what God looks like. He came to reveal to us what a righteous life looks like. He came to teach. He came to heal. He came for many purposes. But ultimately, Christ's first coming was to seek and to save sinners. And let's share the story of one final sinner. Maybe the most unlikely of all sinners for Jesus to come for. Beginning in verse number 1 of chapter 19, we read this incredibly familiar story in which Luke writes, he, speaking of Jesus, entered Jericho and was passing through. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. And he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and he said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. So he hurried and he came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled, he is gone to be a guest of the man who is a sinner. And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Very quickly, I just want to take a look at the story. It begins with Jesus arriving in the city of Jericho. We last week, if you were here, were watching Jesus as he passed by Jericho, we're told. Jericho actually was built really in two cities. There was the Old Testament city. You remember the story of Joshua marching around the city and the walls falling down. The old city was never fully rebuilt, but there was a new city built. And so it's very possible that chapter 18 ends as Jesus is passing from one city to the next. But Jesus, as pilgrims often did, made this long journey. We've talked about it in the past, how the Jews from Galilee refused to walk through Samaria. They hated them so badly, and so they would walk a day's journey out of their way, and they would cross on the east side of the Jordan River and make their way down, and they would cross just across from Jericho. And thus Jericho became this incredibly important city. It was a city in the middle of the deserts. A few years ago, we went through the series That the World May Know. And if you look at some of the pictures that were taken on that very road Jesus was walking, you get an idea as to where he's walking. Last week, when we didn't have rain for a while, and I saw all of the grass begin to turn brown, I thought, my, this is terrible. How would you like to have this be your front yard? This be the path that you walk on. This is the land just outside of Jericho. And as Jesus would have been walking with his disciples, Jericho is hot. It's undoubtedly well warmer than it will be here today. And he's making his way up to Jericho. And Jericho is this amazing oasis. There are springs there that suddenly allow this city just to pop out of nowhere. It was known for its balsam trees. Now, when I was growing up, we made airplanes out of balsam wood. In the first century, balsam was used for perfume, and it was said that you could smell Jericho long before you could see it. You could sense this incredibly aromatic perfume that filled the air. But maybe more than anything, Jericho was known as a city in which trade routes combined. If you were coming from the Middle East and headed to Egypt, you most likely came down along the east side of the Jordan River and crossed to Jericho. If you were headed, as one of the pilgrims were, from the area of Galilee down to Jerusalem, you crossed and you walked into Jericho. And this Jericho becomes this incredibly important city because it's a place where taxes were collected. Unlike our world, where April 15th is the day that you have the wonderful privilege of paying your taxes, in the ancient world, most of the time you paid your taxes as a tax collector set up a roadblock and decided what he wanted to tax you on. And there was no place more important, more prominent, a higher tax yield than the city of Jericho. And thus Jesus comes, and it seems as if his intention is simply to pass through Jericho. He's about 15 miles as the crow flies to the city of Jerusalem. I was reading one individual who made the walk and concluded that it took him 6.5 hours of walking. It took him over 8 hours of actual travel time because you simply couldn't walk the 3,500 feet above ground as you would go up the hill and in this heat. And so we're talking about a day's journey to Jerusalem. He stops. And suddenly we're introduced to Zacchaeus. What do you know about Zacchaeus? If you're anything like I am, my guess is when you hear the word Zacchaeus, leaping to the front of your brain was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he. We remember the story, the song that we sang as kids, and it just comes to the forefront. But what do we really know about Zacchaeus? Well, the answer is not a lot. We get a sense as to where his parents were. We've talked oftentimes about the importance of names in the first century. The Jews were very careful not to choose a name to sound pretty, but rather to reflect the character of what they hoped their child would be. Zacchaeus literally means the pure one, the righteous one. It seems like not too much of a stretch to consider that his parents longed for Zacchaeus to be righteous. But he turned out to be anything but righteous. He turned out to be a tax collector. I know in our world we aren't terribly fond of tax collectors. I read a story this week of a gym owner who was known for his strength. In fact, he was very proud of it, and so he set up a contest. He offered $1,000 to anybody who could demonstrate that they were stronger than he was. The test was this. He kept lemons on hand, and he would cut a lemon in half, and he would squeeze the lemon for all it was worth, and then he would hand it to you. And if you could get another drop out, you got the $1,000. Well, he had professional athletes come in, weightlifters, bodybuilders, some of the strongest of the strong, and no one was ever able. And one day, a gentleman, a thin guy, a balding guy, an old guy came in with glasses on. He said, "I'd like to challenge you." After laughing, he says, "Are you serious?" He says, "Yes." And so finally, he cuts the lemon in half, and he squeezes for all he's worth, and he hands it to him. And the gentleman puts his hand on it, and he begins to squeeze. And soon, one drop, then two, then three, then six drops out of the lemon. The gym owner hands him the money and says, "I must admit, you've bested me, but I've got to know, what do you do for a living?" And he responds, "I work for the IRS. You know, we laugh about that because we don't like the idea of having our pennies squeezed out of us. We don't like people taking our money to spend on things that we think are a waste. In the first century, a tax collector was much worse than somebody just taking our money. He was an extortionist. He was a thief. He was a traitor. The Romans were willing to allow you a great deal of freedom if you promised to do two things: not rebel and pay your taxes. And because Rome didn't want their hands dirty, they would hire people who would then collect their taxes. And they quite literally were given the full force of the Roman army to collect whatever they wanted. The only limitation to the amount of money a tax collector could collect was his own morality. And Zacchaeus was not just a tax collector. He is the chief tax collector. The only place in the New Testament this expression is used. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to suggest that not only was he a tax collector, but he was the tip of the pyramid. He was the tax collector of tax collectors, maybe over all of Palestine. He was the one that everybody hated. His job becomes an obstacle to him following Christ. But I would suggest there's a second obstacle, and one that I think maybe we don't see as an obstacle as large as we should. He was rich. We live in a land where, if we're honest, the belief system is that money solves all problems. Education is bad in this country. What's the solution? Give more money to it. The people in the Middle East hate us. What's the solution? Give them some money. They'll like us. Almost every problem we face, the solution is if we just throw some money at it, things will get better. And it is so easy for each of us to begin to believe the lie that if you have enough money, you'll have happiness, security, and enjoyment in this life. Now, I want to be careful because I think there's two extremes that oftentimes come out when people begin to speak on the subject of money from the Bible. There are those who preach a prosperity gospel, this idea that if God is really pleased with you, He will give you money. If you don't have money, it means you're doing something wrong. But I think there's the other extreme that's equally wrong. There is a poverty gospel, if you will. Belief that no one should have anything, that in order to be a true Christian, you need to take a vow of poverty. I think we need to avoid both extremes, but I say that with a bit of caution because I think if we're honest, if I'm honest, it's easy to begin to see riches as no big deal. This week, I was just kind of curious. I don't want to take too much of a rabbit trail, but I began to think about what Luke has to say about money. I don't know if you've ever done a study. I'd encourage you to do it sometime. Luke, of all of the gospel writers, speaks most often about the wealthy, and may I suggest in the least favorable light. In fact, in chapter 1 of the book, he begins with Mary's prayer, as Mary is chosen as the mother of Messiah. And as she prays, He, speaking of God, has brought down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of humble estate. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich He sent away empty. And you begin to see this theme in the Gospel of Luke. You see in chapter 6, as Jesus is preaching on the Sermon on the Plain, we called it. One of the woes is dedicated to the wealthy who Jesus declares, you have already enjoyed your time. We come to chapter 12 and there's the story of the rich farmer. And the rich farmer tears down his barns and builds bigger barns. And Jesus says that God said, today your life will be required of you. Chapter 16, the story of Lazarus and the rich man. And as the rich man wakes up in torment, Abraham says that you got to enjoy your wealth. Now Lazarus is enjoying prosperity. And then last week, or 2 weeks ago, when we were in chapter 18, there's the story of the rich ruler, who by all accounts was the perfect candidate to be a follower of Christ. He was a moral man. He was a religious man. When Jesus says, do you keep the commandments? He lists off the last five, and with a straight face, he says, all of them I have done since my youth. And Jesus says, well, there's one thing left. Sell everything that you have, give it to the poor, and follow me. And the man walks away sad. Why? Because he was very wealthy. Wealth has a temptation for us. It has this belief system that if I have enough, surely I will be okay. I don't want to take a lot of time, but if we were to go back to 1 Timothy chapter 6, I would encourage you to go there sometime because I love Paul's dealing with money. We all remember verse 10 in which Paul will say that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and that's usually the passage people go to. But I love Paul's account for those of us who have wealth, and may I suggest Paul is going to define wealth as having more food than you can eat, more clothes than you can wear, and adequate shelter. By that definition, I would argue almost all of us here are wealthy. And he's going to say, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, not to be proud, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of wealth. Paul says, don't get caught up and think you're something more than you are, and please don't trust in your wealth, but rather God, and I love this phrase, who richly provides everything to enjoy. Wealth is not wrong. God gives it for us to enjoy. But, he says, as you enjoy it, they ought to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. Paul says, wealth is not wrong. We ought to enjoy it. but we also ought to be willing to share it. But as Zacchaeus comes, he is struck with this incredible obstacle that he is very wealthy. But maybe his most famous obstacle, the one that we all remember, is his stature. He's short. He couldn't see Jesus. He had a hard time finding Jesus. And I would guess that people were not very willing to allow him to see Jesus. I don't know if you're a state fair goer, if you enjoy the crowds at the state fair, but if you do, you may really enjoy the Middle East. When I was in India, crowds were incredible. I'd describe them as the state fair on steroids. They're shoving and pushing. They've never seen a line. They don't know what lines are for. They're shoving and pushing. And if you are the short fellow, the likelihood of you seeing Jesus is almost impossible to imagine. But he wouldn't allow his obstacles to stop him. In fact, he does what people didn't do. We've talked about it in the past. He runs. Rich people in the first century didn't run. I was reminded this past week that a while ago my family watched The Princess Diaries. I don't know if you've seen the movie. If you don't have young girls in your house, you probably haven't. But it's a story of a young girl who imagines amazing enough, finds out that she is the heir to the throne of a small kingdom in Europe, and her grandmother comes and trains her to be a princess. And one of her first lessons is this: the queen is never late. Everyone else is just early. You never rush as queen. Everybody will wait on you because, after all, your schedule is the only one that matters. That's the mentality of the first century wealthy. I don't run for anything. I don't want anybody to think I'm in a hurry because I'm not. They'll wait for me. For Zacchaeus, the chief tax collector, to run was unbelievable. And then he does even a more amazing thing. He scurries up a tree. When was the last time you climbed a tree? I was listening to a pastor, and he was sharing the story of his 12-year-old son, whose job it was to take the garbage out. No, this isn't my 12-year-old son. A different 12-year-old son, whose job it was to take the garbage out. And his wife saw him stepping out a second-floor window onto a tree branch holding a garbage bag. And she says, "What in the world are you doing?" And his response, "It's shorter, Mom. You know, we're not surprised if a 12-year-old climbs down a tree because it's shorter." What would you think if you get home this afternoon and you look up and there I am sitting in your tree? Or better, you drive home and suddenly you see President Obama in your tree or Governor Branstad sitting in your tree. Wouldn't you call the guys with the padded trucks and the white jackets? You don't do that. 40, 50, 60-year-old guys don't climb trees. Zacchaeus knew that the pilgrims took the same route through the city of Jericho every year. He knew which route they were on. He runs ahead. He finds this tree. When I was in Israel, I found the tree Zacchaeus climbs. In the words of my professor, this tree, planted in 1950, was the very tree that Zacchaeus climbed up. But it gives you an idea of what sycamore trees look like. They would have been easy to climb. And I can just envision this short little guy standing up in the tree, laying in the tree, waiting for Jesus to come. And as Jesus comes by, he suddenly stops. And he says a single word: Zacchaeus. Someone has once said the most pleasant sounding word in all the world is the sound of your name. How did Jesus know Zacchaeus' name? I could theorize that, remember, one of Jesus' 12 disciples was a tax collector by the name of Levi, changed to Matthew. It is certainly within the realm of possibility that Matthew had said, "Jesus, there's a tax collector in the city of Jericho I really want you to meet. Can you meet Zacchaeus?" But I would suggest that maybe more likely, we could go back to 1 John, or John chapter 1 rather. And in John chapter 1, Jesus is choosing another of his disciples, a man by the name of Nathanael. And as Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him, he said to him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." And Nathanael's response was, "How do you know who I am? How do you know me?" And Jesus answered, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Jesus wasn't there, and yet he saw Nathanael. I am convinced that Jesus knew Zacchaeus. May I suggest Jesus knows you as well. And this morning, as he's passing by through his word, he stops and he calls your name. And he says to Zacchaeus, if you can clear your calendar and don't have any conflicts, would really like to have coffee. It's not exactly what he says. He says there is a divine requirement. Not that we eat together. That was unimaginable. If you go back to chapter 5, in chapter 5, Jesus meets Levi and he says, leave everything and follow me. And Levi does, and he throws a banquet in his own house and invites a number of tax collectors. And the people are aghast. Jesus eats with sinners. It's not what Jesus is asking for here. Jesus is asking to spend the night at Zacchaeus' house. The last night before Jesus enters Jerusalem. For passion. He stays in a sinner's house. And the people are aghast. They can't believe that anybody would do that, but not Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus hurries and he comes down. I am convinced that Satan's greatest tool in his arsenal is not reject Christ. Don't follow Christ ever. It's don't follow him right now. You're young. You're relatively young. Okay, you're somewhat old, but not that old. You've got lots of time left. You can follow him tomorrow. You can follow him next year. You can follow him sometime in the future. But Zacchaeus doesn't wait. He comes down immediately. He hurries down, and with great joy, he invites Jesus to spend the night with him. And then as you come to verse number 8, Zacchaeus stands up, and I'm convinced there's an entire evening between verse number 7 and verse number 8. And in the next morning, Zacchaeus stands. And he says, behold, Lord. Jesus has now become Zacchaeus' Lord. And he says, the half of my goods I give to the... Wait a second. That's not fair. Why half? Didn't Jesus require of the rich ruler all? Why does Zacchaeus get to only give half? That isn't fair. May I suggest that the point was not that Jesus demands all our money. He demands our heart. And if our money is consuming our heart, then we must begin with the money. But what he ultimately wants is our heart. And without request, without requirement, Zacchaeus says, I give you half the money to the poor. And then he goes on and he says, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. Where did he come up with that? If you go back to the Old Testament, you'll find that in the Jewish society, there was no incarceration. We treat criminals today primarily through incarceration. If you go back to the Old Testament, there's nothing of jail. They didn't put people in jail. What they did was, for certain offenses, they had capital penalty. You murder somebody, you rape somebody, you do a number of different crimes, it's a capital offense, your life is taken. If you do something less bad, there was corporal punishment. They used whipping and caning and flogging. If you were a criminal, there was restitution. And generally speaking, if you stole from somebody, you were required to pay back 20% more than you stole. I steal $100 from you. My requirement would be then to pay back $120. But in Exodus 22, there's this story for the worst of thefts, the worst robbery, you could be charged 4 or 5 times. And I think it's fascinating that Zacchaeus chooses not the least penalty, but the maximum penalty. Why? Because I am convinced that as we invite Christ into our life, we change. I'm convinced the reason why Luke includes this as part of the story is because he's wanting us to understand that faith works. Now, we don't work to get faith. We don't work to obligate God's kindness to us. We don't work to earn his favor. We could never do that. But when he changes us, when we truly believe, the result will always be a change, a work. Zacchaeus, who was known as the criminal of criminals, the thieves of thieves, says, I will give back fourfold. And Jesus says, today, salvation has come to this house. As we close, let me just ask two questions. Number one, what's keeping you from following Christ this morning? What's keeping you from fully following Christ? For some of you, it may very well be your job. Maybe your job's requiring too much time, too much energy. Maybe it's requiring too much of your effort. I don't know. For some of you, it may be your money. You can't envision the idea of giving all and following Christ. Maybe it's your stature. There's just something about me. If God had really wanted me, He'd have made me different. Maybe it's something completely different. But this morning, Christ is here and is saying, I want you. But I don't want to leave without really thinking about that last phrase. I think most of us here this morning have chosen to follow Christ. But Luke could say that Jesus' life was summed up in his passion to seek and to save those who are lost. Granted, you and I can't save anyone. But do we have a passion to seek them? Last week, what did you do to seek someone you know isn't a follower of Christ? I'm afraid it's far too easy for us to get comfortable with where we are, comfortable with the people we hang around with, get involved in ministering to the brothers, caring for those who are hurting in our group, which are all wonderful things, giving money to those who are going across the sea, wonderful thing. But I am convinced God expects all of us who have found Him and chosen to follow Him to make a concerted effort to reach those around us. But do we? I want to challenge you this week to allow your life to really reflect one who has been found. I read a story of two gentlemen who were out hunting. They were doing some pheasant hunting, and as they were crossing the field, they came to a barbed wire fence, and as they climbed over the fence, Dave tripped, and as he did, his gun went off, discharged into his leg. His friend who was hunting with him, Joe, suddenly realized that his leg was in terrible shape, and he took off his belt, and he put a belt around and used it as a tourniquet and stopped the bleeding, but then he began to realize that the car was 2 miles away. Realizing his friend was going to be unable to walk, he threw him on his back, and he made the trek 2 miles, carrying him all the way, threw him in the back of the pickup and rushed him to the emergency room, and the doctors were able to save his life and to save the leg. Several years later, Joe had a heart attack, needed bypass surgery, and Dave sat at his side. In fact, he sat there not for an hour, but for several days until finally one of the doctors came to him and said, he's doing fine, you really need to go home and get some rest. And Dave's reply was, you don't understand. He saved my life. I have to be here for him. Do we feel that way about Christ? He saved my life, and whatever the cost, I will give it. Are we just happy that He called my name and now I can enjoy the rest of this life? Are we excited to seek those who are lost? Father, I bow in Your presence this morning. And I do ask that You would work in the heart of anyone here this morning that hasn't chosen to follow You, has never come to that place where they recognize their need as Zacchaeus did, and are willing to overcome any obstacle to find You. Father, if there's anyone like that, I ask, I plead, I beg that they would talk to me, talk to someone who could open Your word and show them how they can truly be a child of Yours, how You can save them. For those of us who have chosen to follow You, help our lives to change. Help us to be consumed with sharing You to our neighbors, to our coworkers, to our friends, to our family, to anyone and everyone who will listen. Father, I pray as we gather again next week and the weeks to come, that we might be able to celebrate together lives that have been changed, because we're willing to be Your spokesman. We've been willing to share the good news that You shared with us. Thank You for what You have done Thank you for what you will do. For it is in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much for coming this morning.